Widowmaker. Tommy cannot breathe. His 31 years of smoking Luckies have shortened his breath, infusing it with vicious phlegm that makes him cough and keeps Anne awake at night, worrying that he will die as her father did, drowning with short, panic-stricken breaths, unable to oxygenate the blood flowing to his terrified brain. But Tommy is not Anne's father. Tommy is in the woods alone. He is dying, but not of emphysema. He cannot inhale. The crushing weight on his shattered ribs and seizing pain in his chest make it impossible to inhale the forest air. In his close field of vision, the forest floor is a landscape of curled wood chips, some are pale blonde and others cinnabar, the mixed colors of black cherry. Further off, pale green maidenhair fern fronds rise up like a preternatural tree, and in the distance he can see a mound of dark green moss covering a rock. He can hear the gurgling of water flowing over rocks in Potash Brook a few yards away, and there is the sound of a phoebe trilling in the woods. Tommy is remembering where he is in the woods. He is far from Anne, far from their house, far from anyone. It is early April, and trout season 2 weeks away. The kids he often surprises fishing on his woodlot are still in school. The fierce pain in his chest is increasingly anesthetized by the body's chemistry of shock. Instinct causes him to inhale, but pain overwhelms instinct, and he relaxes, breathless. His right temple is flat against the damp moss. He fell hard on his right side when his steel-toed boot caught in a loop of woody grapevine hidden among dead leaves. It happened fast. He tries to recall the sequence of events. The 60-foot black cherry had pinched the bar on his saw as it began to fall. He let go of the saw and moved aside, but his boot caught fast in the vine. He and the tree fell in the same arc. He sees a wild turkey strutting hesitantly towards him, lifting each three-toed foot very carefully, setting it down gently before taking another step, always cautious, always guarded. Tommy is no threat, however. The turkey seems to know this, ambling ever closer, pausing at each step to scratch the ground cover and peck at worms and bugs beneath the bed of leaves. A few feet away, he stops, glances at Tommy, but goes on with his feeding. As the bird moves closer, Tommy notices how the wary Tom resembles the bronze meat birds his aunt raises each summer, lacking only the heavy chest and height. The coloring is the same. Gradually, it struts away, all the while disturbing the earth and eating what it finds. It is the closest Tommy has ever been to a live wild turkey. He is used to seeing them in springtime, flocks of 20 or 30, foraging in the corn stubble in his lower field, while the snow is still on the ground. The Tom disappears over the knoll that forms the west bank of Potash Brook. Tommy can still hear him scrabbling among the dry leaves, even over the sounds of the brook. The pale blue two-cycle exhaust that hangs in the air when Tommy's chainsaw is whining has dissipated. The resinous smell of wounded wood is everywhere, mingled with the acrid odor of bar and chain oil. The hot saw lies sideways on the ground, stalled and quiet. Gas oil mix leaks slowly from the carburetor. Tommy could never get it to idle properly without his hand on the throttle, something about the carburetor mixture he could never get right. He is exhausted from the pain in his chest. Trying again to draw breath, a stab of pain from the rib that has pierced his lung overwhelms his effort. He stares at the fern fronds and listens to the water in the brook. In his mind, he sees the 5 or 6 inch brookies under the banks undulating slowly to hold their place in the gentle current, an occasional flash of rose-colored light as one drifts into the midstream sun. He closes his eyes to rest and smells them in a black iron skillet, sizzling in butter over the wood stove at home. Anne is breaking fresh eggs on the other side of the pan. The blue graniteware coffee pot sits on the far right of the wood stove, away from the intense heat of the firebox. His favorite breakfast. His vision is blurring. He is dizzy, but not yet confused. When he opens his eyes, the fern fronds now appear like an ancient tree, the moss a bracken hill in the distance. Tommy himself is tiny. The wood chips are the size of cedar shakes and dominate his short field of vision. Anne has always been there for him when he needed her, but this time she does not know he needs her, so she cannot help him. He left early that morning. He arose quietly from their tousled bed, leaving Anne sleeping beneath a clump of quilts. They had made love the night before slowly, the way he and Anne both liked. Anne was shy about sex and had never gotten comfortable with a harsh anatomical lexicon of sex. Gradually, they had adopted a language of flowers. Anne would whisper to Tommy, "Pollinate me," and their lovemaking would begin. The shared metaphor was their secret, adding pleasure. Anne got a book from the library and took a furtive sensual pleasure in her study of floral reproduction, introducing and explaining new words and their meaning to Tommy, often as part of their foreplay. They talked in an intimate code of petals, pistils, stamens, pollen, and efflorescence. Before he left, he rebuilt the fire in the kitchen stove from last night's embers, first with biscuit wood, then with two splits of maple. The Glenwood cook stove, with its rusty chrome that had been there when they bought the abandoned hill farm, came slowly to life and began broadcasting heat in the kitchen and then up through a cast iron register into their bedroom above. It was his second marriage and Anne's first. Anne never asked Tommy about his first marriage, as they had been friends through the sad and empty ritual of most of it. Like most of his friends, Tommy married while in high school. Some married as they were about to be fathers, others for what they thought was love. Tommy had liked her well enough, but might not have taken her for a wife were she not bearing his child. With the help of Father McDonough, Tommy convinced himself that he loved her. She, too, was Catholic, though French, not Irish. This added pressure on both to legitimize their new child in marriage. As was often the case, she was visibly pregnant at the service. The marriage lasted a little over 2 years. Tommy came to understand that he could never fill the billowing emptiness in her left by an alcoholic father and overly religious mother. After Jeanette was born, he gave up. One Sunday, after returning from Mass, she simply helped herself to his pickup in lieu of child payments and left with Jeanette for her father's home in Barton to care for him in his alcoholic twilight. Soon after, she landed a state job. On the Friday after his wife and daughter decamped, he got a terse letter postmarked in Barton. He was to see Jeanette for a few weeks in the summer and at Easter, but he never did. After her father died of a grueling stomach cancer, his wife of 2 years remarried a man who did not drink and never got angry. Tommy felt the irony, for when his marriage ended, so did his own drinking and anger. Twice he sent a brown envelope of cash to Barton, but both times it came back unopened, so he stopped. He left for the woods, moving into his father's deer camp in Sterling Valley, and began logging in earnest. His father had been an avid hunter, taking Tommy into the woods with him when he was just 5. Malon, too, had married for paternity, but his marriage to Tommy's mother survived the hardscrabble times and youthful drinking and grew into a durable friendship. Ella had a persistent and disruptive sense of humor. When things went south, as his father used to say, Ella could always find something or someone to laugh at, including herself. This diverted many family crises from tears, anger, and harsh words to gales of laughter and eventual calm. Malon died under a 1954 Ford Fairlane while removing the plug from the oil pan to drain and change the oil for his neighbor, Hilda Hartigan. She lived in a trailer and a slurry of junk food and cheap sherry. She counted on neighbors to rescue her from various alcoholic misadventures. Malon would periodically help her out, thawing a frozen pipe or changing worn tires or oil. He was about to drain the oil under the jacked-up Ford when she leaned on the fender, pushing the car off the scissor jack. The full weight of the rusty Ford's drivetrain landed on Malon's chest, pinning him to the damp lawn under his back. Panicked, Hilda fumbled with the scissor jack lying on its side, all the while talking to Malon, who could not answer. Well, after he stopped breathing, she told him to wait a bit while she went to get some more sherry and call a neighbor to help her lift the car off him. Ella never left the community and never remarried, seeing her son on Sundays for breakfast. Tommy and Anne had always been casual friends in school, not seeing each other, but rather finding themselves together occasionally. After the breakup of his marriage, they ran into each other in the hospital where Tommy was visiting a friend badly mangled when his tractor tipped over on him. Anne was an LPN with plans to become a registered nurse. He had always been drawn to her winning smile and the way she lowered her eyes when he returned the smile. He asked her to the 4th of July fire station dance. She accepted, and they were married 2 months later in the town clerk's office in Derby Line. They honeymooned for a week in a damp motel room with swollen and water-stained homosote walls across the border in Quebec, emerging only long enough to have breakfast and look around the small town of Stansted. With a loan from his mother, Tommy had enough to make a down payment on a farm high up on the side of Sterling Mountain. The Lamoille Bank had foreclosed on it 2 years earlier. With a $1,000 down payment, a 25-year mortgage, and payments of $76 a month, Tommy and Ann had a home of their own. The bank was relieved of another failed hill farm and uninhabitable house. Ann and Tommy loved the house, with its 5-by-3-foot flat slab of bluestone lying in front of the door. The outside bore no trace of its former paint, so Ann and Tommy set to work to seal the dried-out wood with creosote from Graves Hardware. The house absorbed half again as much as Jack Graves had calculated it would. When they came back for more, he surmised that the raised grain of the badly weathered wood presented twice as much surface to seal. The place looked no different when they were finished, but they had slowed the long decay and deterioration. On the inside, they did little other than to inhibit decay by pulling up the old linoleum, sanding and sealing the wide pumpkin pine floors, and patching and repainting plaster walls. The electrical wiring, a network of porcelain insulators with cotton-wrapped copper wire running from rotary porcelain switches to cracked porcelain sockets, had to be replaced. They agreed they only really needed electricity in the kitchen to run the refrigerator, a GE toaster Anne had brought into the marriage, the white Maytag wringer washer with its cast aluminum agitator and rubber drain hoses, and a single bulb in a new white porcelain fixture in the middle of the kitchen ceiling. Tommy wired the kitchen while Anne painted. Tommy later added another outlet to plug in the red heat tape he spiral-wrapped around the incoming water pipe to keep it from freezing as it cascaded into the cast-iron sink from the spring box on the hillside above. They reveled together in how little they would do, agreeing to stabilize what was there, not to change or enhance it. They loved it as they found it and wanted only to preserve it. Their woodlot covers 140 acres and abuts the old Langerand farm with its 800 acres of hardwoods. The Langerand widow lets Tommy work her woods as well in return for 15% of the mill price. Tommy culls, cuts, and sells pulpwood in 4-foot lengths, cordwood in 20 and 24-inch lengths, and lumber in mill lengths. He works alone, cutting and stacking wood in place and then retrieving it from the woods with his John Deere 510 and an old manure spreader into which he loads the wood. Tommy is almost always happy in the woods and looks forward to coming home to Anne. Anne, too, is resourceful with wood. She can heft a running saw and cut birch and maple whips into biscuit wood for the stove, but has never managed to yank the starter cord hard enough to overcome the compression and get either of Tommy's cranky McCulloughs to fire. Anne likes to say she doesn't cut trees down, she cuts them up. Tommy always adds, only if they're lying in a sawbuck. She prefers a sharp bucksaw. He thinks of Anne now, but his brain, bereft of oxygen, produces only fleeting evanescent images and sensations from different times in his life, watching his mother, then younger than Anne, knead bread on a bird's-eye maple board with the rich smell of the yeasty dough permeating the kitchen. Anne using a baby teacup dipped in boiling water, hot to the point of pain, to draw wasp venom out of his forearm where he had been stung multiple times after a falling tree disturbed a nearby paper nest. Helping his Uncle Norman split wood to heat the still in his ramshackle cedar oil mill, playing doctor with Annie Stewart in her stern father's hayloft, and discovering the aching thrill and fear of passion, learning to drive Pete Trepanier's tractor at the age of 11. The images and their sensations subside. With great effort, Tommy opens his eyes and sees only light. He hears the brook. His last thought is of Anne and how angry she will be to see him lying dead under a tree whose trunk is 3 times the size of his own. A small runnel of blood appears in his left nostril.